Hello, and welcome to the Game Audio Hour, a fortnightly podcast where we discuss all things game audio. From creative ideas to the latest techniques, project experiences to audio secrets, here is where you'll find in-depth coverage and opinions related to game audio. Am I going to do that? No, I'm not going to do that, because I did that last time, alluding to the very strange phenomenon we have here in Southern California. You might know about it, but it's like this wet precipitant that's falling from the skies. We don't usually have that here, but we had the same thing happen the last time that we were on the air. So I'm not going to talk about it now. Instead, I'm just going to say, hey, I'm Vince, and it's pretty good to be back in town and dealing with game audio again, especially talking to you fine folks. Let's see, who is here? It's Mike. Mike, how are you doing over there?
I'm doing well. I've got my handy space heater because my studio is not particularly heated. So the space heater is getting me through this, for what, by Southern California standards, this is apocalyptic cold. But for the rest of the country, this would just be spring. Doing well. How about you?
Yeah, I'm doing pretty well, too. I haven't had to worry too much about that. I think I've mentioned before on this podcast that I do most of my work in a box. And this box, I need to keep the ventilation up if I want to keep it cooler. So keeping the door closed, actually, with the equipment in here, it gets to a nice temperature, even in these unusual temperatures that we have here for SoCal. It's pretty nice here. I am hoping that it is similarly nice for you over there, Alex. How are you doing?
I'm actually somewhat exhausted, so I apologize in advance if I make absolutely no sense whatsoever, or even less sense than usual whatsoever in today's episode. But otherwise, I'm healthy, and it indeed is a balmy minus 2 Celsius, which is degrees below the freezing temperature of water. Here in Stockholm in Sweden. I'm just going to jump straight into something that's sort of moderately game audio. Okay, it's not really game audio, but it does kind of affect us. I'm actually doing quite a bit better today than compared to yesterday, because yesterday I've been doing a lot of intense sort of sound effects work at the moment for this project that we're working on, and I was having some wrist trouble. And it's never really happened to me before, because, you know, I guess as a bass player, I have fairly strong fingers and, you know, a pretty resilient wrist, I thought. But, you know, I'm getting older and not as soft and flexible as I used to be. And yeah, yesterday, just like after a heavy duty day of a lot of clicking, I was just finding that my wrist just around, kind of scarily, the carpal tunnel area, so on the underside of my wrist at the heel of my palm, was feeling really tight and kind of tingling and a bit numb. And I thought, okay, that's bad. Like also as a bass player, I've built up a little bit of knowledge about carpal tunnel syndrome, and there's another one, something syndrome, which is based in the elbow, to know that, okay, these are warning signs. So I took immediate action, and I went out and purchased, like I literally walked out and immediately went to the electronics shop and purchased for myself a Logitech vertical mouse.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. This comes at strong recommendation from Therese, my colleague at Moonmode, who is slowly, person by person, converting everybody that she knows into, you know, a vertical mouse fan. And so I thought, I'll just give it a try. So for those who don't know, the theory is that when you use a standard mouse, you have your the base of your palm will be resting on the table, and that's actually putting pressure on the underside of your wrist, which is where there is a small channel known as the carpal tunnel, where there's a lot of important circulation being thrust through this tiny small channel there. And if you are obstructing that channel for whatever reason, either through the angle of your wrist or because in this case, because you got rested on the table, it can cause problems when you're doing a lot of repetitive motions. And in the case of our work, lots of clicking around. So with a vertical mouse, the idea is that your arm is no longer twisted and your hand is basically like you're about to give somebody a handshake. And so it's pointing upwards. And then, of course, the idea is then the weight of your arm is on the side of your wrist and not on the base of it, therefore sort of freeing up that carpal tunnel for more, you know, free and open circulation. So that's the theory anyway.
I'm looking at the website for that product, and it looks like it keeps your hand in a position roughly equivalent to shaking somebody's hand. So if you just hold out your hand as if you were going to shake your hand, that's kind of, you know, you slide a weird, roughly like a clothes iron shaped object into it. That seems to be the deal.
Yeah, yeah, that's that describes it very well, actually. They do look like little miniature clothes irons. Anyway, so Logitech make two versions of these. One's called the MX Vertical, and the other one's called the Logitech Lift. The Lift is slightly smaller, and it is the newer model with a lot of the updated features, and the MX Vertical is the larger previous model. Anyway, so I got that yesterday, and I've been using it the remainder of yesterday and all day today. And I'm happy to report, it actually works.
Wow.
It's very good. It surprisingly, it does take a little bit of getting used to, but really it's only practically about maybe 30 minutes and it feels quite natural. And yeah, after again today having to do a lot of clicking around, I don't have any tension on the underside of my wrist, which is great. Instead, there's a little bit of tension along my pointer finger. That's probably because I'm not used to, you know, moving my pointer finger on with this angle of my arm. I think maybe it could be a situation that I basically just shifted the strain from the carpal tunnel to the top of my wrist, but time will tell. We'll see. But for the meantime, you know, those kinds of red flag symptoms like tingling and numbness and things like that, which are definitely signs of onset of something like RSI or carpal tunnel syndrome, have gone today. If any of our wonderful esteemed game audio colleagues out there are suffering from any kinds of problems like this, or sore wrists or numbness, I can, at least for my situation, and of course everybody's physiology is totally different, but at least for me, this has worked. So there you go. Do either of you have any ergonomic sort of solutions or things that you've got actively in operation?
Well, I actually have, I think, that exact same Logitech vertical mouse. I've got the MX Vertical right here, and I've been using it for a few months, and it's pretty great. My wife, she actually has that smaller one, the Lift. It's actually been pretty great for both of us, actually. I know she has some similar but not quite manifesting the exact same way pains in her wrist. And she's gone to a vertical mouse. Before she had the Logitech version, she had another vertical mouse, so she's a big proponent. And actually, she was the one that dragged me into this, and it's pretty great. It took a while for me to get used to it, mostly because I was used to even more full-featured mice that would have extra buttons that I would assign to special Reaper actions and whatnot, and I would go with gamer mice. Logitech makes another mouse called the MX Master 3, which has, you know, now that I think about it, just a few more buttons, especially on the thumb and next to the scroll wheel, that I used for various Reaper actions, things like changing the mode of my mouse cursor or changing how I edit my CCs and stuff like that. I found it very useful to have those actions on hand on the mouse itself. I've had to sacrifice that a little bit, but I think that's a pretty small sacrifice compared to just being able to move the mouse totally pain-free. I really haven't had any complaint about arm or wrist pain or fatigue in many months now.
So were you actually suffering from that before?
Not to a huge degree, it would just be, oh, every now and then, maybe after a few long nights of work in a row, it's like, oh, yeah, I really wish that my wrist was better. And I would always usually berate myself by saying, ah, it's because I'm not practicing piano the way that I used to. And it's like, I don't have the endurance that I had back when I was a college student and stuff like that. And then I would take a little bit of a break, you know, after the weekend, the pain would go away and I wouldn't think about it for a while until maybe another bit of crunch time. Nowadays I haven't had to deal with that at all. I can't think of the last time that I had any specific, wrist pain in my mousing hand.
Actually, when I was investigating options for myself, or solutions yesterday, there were obviously the other two options, the elephant in the room for audio people. And I'm really curious to ask both of your opinions about why this is, but the trackball. For some reason, the trackball is very popular in audio production. So we'll get back to that. So just hold that thought. But the other option was a pen tablet. And while I was investigating, I wasn't sure about, I didn't want to continue using my regular mouse while I was browsing the web to look for options for myself. So I actually pulled out an old Wacom tablet that I have, or Wacom. And plugged that in, and I was using that for a while, just for a few hours while I was investigating options. And I tried using Cubase and Reaper with a pen tablet as well, just to see how it would feel. And that was quite interesting too. The pen tablet, obviously, ergonomically, it is very similar to a vertical mouse because your hand is in a natural standing up, sort of a handshake position as you're gripping the pen. There were a few things that just felt really good using a DAW with a pen. Obviously, you know, drawing envelopes and things like that, obviously. But something that I didn't really expect, but actually there's a, when you're adjusting the knobs or the interface controls of plugins, especially like EQs or like dragging a knob up and down on a graphical interface, like any one of any compressor or something like that, where there's a knob that you're sort of grabbing and dragging up and down, it feels really good with a pen interface for some reason.
Yeah.
I don't know why. I think it might be because you press down and then you move your entire hand. I guess you do that with a mouse too, don't you? I don't know why. Anyway, it just felt really sort of tactile grabbing a knob and moving it up and down with a pen. Ultimately, I ended up going with the vertical mouse though, but trackballs, have either of you ever tried them, and what's the deal? Why are they so popular?
I think we all have fond memories of Centipede and Marble Madness and other formative game experiences that use the trackball, but I haven't touched one for computer input since the 90s, and that probably wasn't a good experience.
And Missile Command, I think, was another classic trackball game, wasn't it? Wasn't Missile Command a trackball game?
Oh, yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So why are they so popular in recording studios? You know, if you go on YouTube and you're watching, you know, YouTube videos from audio producers, at least, I don't know, like one out of three of them will have a trackball. I guess one reason could be because if you have your computer on top of a mixing desk, then a trackball is practical because a mouse will just slide right off that. And obviously a trackball doesn't suffer from that issue. Maybe also because musicians, audio people, we may have limited, like very limited desk space because we've got like, you know, synths or other kinds of peripherals or things that we use laid out on the table. But I don't know. I'm not sure that's such a convincing argument for why a trackball is a tool of choice. But what's your hypothesis, Vince? Why is it that trackballs seem to have found a little bit of a niche of popularity amongst audio producers?
Well, I mean, my memory of the trackball is that the big thing it had going for it was just being a really, really big tactile thing. For as much as we like knobs and sliders, often that trackball would be even bigger than those knobs that we're fiddling with on an SSL or, you know, console or whatnot. I actually really liked that back in the day when I was messing around with that. I mean, I've never had a trackball for my own personal setup, but I would go to studios and, you know, they would have a trackball and it would be really nice to just engage a button and then move that trackball. It's just such a big throw for that ball in order to get these really precise movements and input into whatever bit of software, or if it's ganged, you know, as part of like a VCA group for like some channels on your console, it would feel really, really nice. And actually, I was thinking about that while you were talking about how it was really nice to move that pen and have that extreme precision with the pen and all the PPI that those Wacom units actually have, which are typically, you know, many multiples of the standard DPI for a mouse. Maybe not so much these days because modern mice with optical sensors are so good now compared to the dozens and hundreds of DPI that we were used to for mice back in the early 2000s. But now these Logitech mice, like the DPI for these things are 4,000 and 8,000. So the resolution is great and we have great control over them. We've been working with pens all our lives, and so we have great control over them, and relative to the amount of resolution that a Wacom device has, that combination feels really great. Trackballs, they were just so much better than mice back in the day, and it was such a big surface that you had huge control over of. That was really nice back when I was studying how people actually did things in a big studio. But I actually never put a trackball in my personal workflow. It just didn't make that much sense to me. And I actually went the pen route for quite a while I was thinking about alternatives, both in terms of pen tablet computing as well as getting a Wacom type peripheral for your computer. And I really liked it. I thought that was a great way to go.
Yeah, the tricky thing for me was, I only use it for a few hours, so perhaps I didn't give it enough time to properly get used to it. There's so many benefits in terms of what it feels like, because it's such a natural, you know, as you said, you know, we all grow up doing things with pens, and whenever it's not with a computer, we're usually using a pen, and it's it just feels really natural. Also, there was a really good video that I caught on YouTube. If anybody subscribes to the Cubase channel, they'll know there's a producer who produces metal called Mendel, and he uses a Wacom tablet. And there's a video from him explaining, actually it's for Wacom, there's a video for him explaining why he chose to use the tablet. And he said that he had some severe wrist problems and he tried a vertical mouse, but it didn't help. Basically, it just shifted the problem from one part of his hand to another part of his hand. Mm-hmm. And when he went to the pen tablet, the key difference is that, you know, you're holding, all you're doing with the fingers is just holding the pen, and then all of the other motions are done by moving the pen with your whole hand. And so there's far less of that sort of micro muscle movement in operating your fingers, and it's all done with your hand, which is why ergonomically, it could be less fatiguing on your wrist. For me, the tricky thing with the pen was actually doing things like double taps, like double clicks, because I found it very hard. Because if you're not used to a tablet, it's very hard to make sure that the tip of the pen is landing on the tablet at exactly the same place every time you press it, which you need for a double click. You know, if you're going to double click, obviously the mouse has to be in the same spot. Otherwise, it could be interpreted as a drag or something else. So, yeah, perhaps with more patience or more time, I could have gotten used to that. But anyway, I ended up going with the vertical mouse in the end as well.
Yeah. So, okay, I've got that Logitech vertical mouse. You've got that Logitech vertical mouse. Mike, you're not doing the vertical mouse thing, are you? If not, we can convince you. It's great.
Well, let me describe what I've got so far. And then I have to admit being intrigued, having gazed admiringly upon the image of the vertical mouse on the website during the course of this episode. So I have a couple of questions for you. What I've been using, I actually have two input devices, and I tend to switch back and forth between them depending on what I'm doing, or sometimes I'll use one for one purpose and the other for the other. One is the Apple Magic Mouse, which is kind of a minimalist mouse combined with a trackpad. So it works as a mouse. It's it doesn't have any visible buttons on it, which is the Apple way of doing things. But if you press down at the front of it, you'll hear and feel a click. And the surface of the top third functions as a de facto trackpad. So what's handy is if you swish your finger, slide your finger left or right on the top of the mouse, you can scroll the time frame of your main DAW window. And I think one thing that users of a DAW should never have to resort to are scroll bars for moving around the timeline. So that's really handy. And I've also got the Apple Magic Trackpad. I don't think they have a non-magic version of either of these, but and that one is also very pleasing because you can do these four finger gestures. You can kind of curl your fingers in. You can use three fingers, two fingers. You can assign this to lots of functionality, so it works pretty well. And I've been happy with these two for a while. But that having been said, for both of you who are using this vertical mouse, well, all right, short prelude to my question. I think DAWs are among the most ergonomic fiddly of apps in any sphere of computing today. Like, I think it's partially because we insist on emulating the physicality of consoles. So we have these knobs that turn and faders that only slide up and down. And DAWs also have so many options that I think menus and the visual representation of options is often implemented without a lot of thought to ergonomics. So, for example, you might have to move your mouse, or your pointer, I should say, to a location, apply pressure so that a contextual menu pops up, and then you navigate through three or four levels deep. Like, let's say you're picking a plugin and you've got they're organized by manufacturer. And then, so you're holding pressure down to maintain this context menu and then moving in a very small area. You know, if you overshoot that area, your context menu disappears. So this is an ergonomic nightmare. And because of that, I find that agility of input device, this is where I bring this back to the actual topic, agility of input device is super important. So now that you're switching to a mode where your hand is rotated, I guess, 45 degrees relative to what is traditional, do you find that there is a loss of agility, and in particular, the kind of agility necessary for dealing with the very fiddly aspects of DAW ergonomics?
Good question. Vince, do you want to go first?
I'm actually kind of thinking about bowing technique, French versus German bowing of cellos, because it is kind of like that, you know, which motion of the wrist are you doing, like this sort of German, you're sort of using that whole wrist, going with the natural motion of the pivoting of the wrist, whereas the French, you have arguably more control, but you don't have as much strength because you're moving the wrist side to side. So I was actually just thinking about that because I've heard people talk about, oh yeah, why do you do this? And in the end, it's really what they're used to. They learn that way with a particular teacher, and they're perfectly strong / precise the way that they do it relative to others of their caliber. You can do things the French way, you can do things the German way, and it's great. I don't really feel anything when it came to having to adjust or train when it came to precision of moving stuff. The thing that I had to deal with moving to a vertical mouse was two things. One, the fact that this wasn't a gamer mouse, so that so there were a few less buttons to deal with. But also, I think you mentioned this before, Alex, you know, where your fingers actually rested on the buttons was just something I had to adjust a little bit to. And it took me maybe an hour or so to figure out how I'm holding on to the mouse so that I have my index and middle fingers just where I want them to in a way that felt natural. I didn't really feel any real difference when it came to how precise and quick I was moving the mouse into position with the vertical mouse versus the regular mouse. I don't know. What do you think, Alex?
Yeah, actually, there is one thing that I struggle isn't really the right word, because I would rather struggle, using air quotes, I would rather struggle with this problem than the previous problem that I bought this to try and avoid, which of course is carpal tunnel syndrome. But there is one thing, Mike, that is directly related to what you're probably thinking and wondering, and that is that, yes, because it is a vertical mouse, it's not so much having to change the angle of my hand when I'm using it. What has been an issue is I do knock it quite a lot. So if you imagine you've got a regular flat sort of standard mouse, if you're moving your right hand from the mouse to the cursor keys, to the delete key, to the mouse, to the cursor keys, to the delete key, like that, you don't ever have to actually change the angle of your wrist. Your wrist is always at the same, you know, palm down, angle flat to the table. With a vertical mouse, one thing that I found the past day that I've been using is that, yes, like if I take my hand off, I've actually got to lift my hand up off the mouse and then go to the cursor keys. And then to move it back, if I'm not thinking, I'll just move my right hand parallel to the table, directly right, and that will actually knock the vertical mouse because I can't get my hand over it. I have to actually remember, oh yeah, that's right, lift my hand up so that I don't knock the mouse over. Does that make sense?
Yes, absolutely. Because, I can visualize it.
Yeah, it has some vertical height, and so if you try to shift your hand across to it like you would with a flat mouse, you just knock it. And it's never caused a problem. Like, it's knocking it doesn't do anything except just move the mouse pointer. But that has been something that I've had to get used to. As I said, I would much rather get used to that than dealing with wrist pain and sort of potentially, you know, very, very damaging injury to my wrist. So it's been a small sort of sacrifice, but that is one thing that I have found to be inconvenient about the vertical mouse, is just you have to remember to lift your arm up to get over it and on it. So that's much more, obvious a something to get used to than the angle of your wrist, for me anyway.
You know, Mike, you mentioned that trackpad, and I want to add that I actually also use a trackpad in addition to my mouse and keyboard. It started out for practicality's sake because I do use a Mac as my main development machine, and often we would do things in-game that use the trackpad or use the touchscreen in a particular way, and I need to be able to actually test those gestures or use those gestures for debugging purposes. But I've also since attached this trackpad to my KVM, and that allows me to use it on my PC, where even though it's an Apple Magic trackpad, there are drivers for this thing for Windows, and it works a treat. It's really, really good. It's so much better than most any PC trackpad. I know a lot of people know this already, but you know, the trackpad on the MacBook Pro is such a good trackpad compared to pretty much anything that you can get in the PC space, except for the very, very best stuff. I wonder if part of the relief of pain that I've experienced is not just switching to the vertical mouse, but also adding that extra modality that I can utilize whenever, you know, just, sometimes I want to use the mouse for my general navigation. Sometimes I want to use the trackpad. Sometimes because I have my keyboard out, I actually have my trackpad attached to to the top of my keyboard with a little bit of a sticky pad. And it's not that much of a move. It's a few centimeters from the MIDI keyboard to the Magic Trackpad, and then a few more centimeters from that to my keyboard and vertical mouse. Moving between all those things, maybe that has also been a part of the relief of my pain.
Yeah, that's right. definitely the case. That's what, you know, and it's the same deal with chairs as well. And one of the reasons why standing desks have become so popular in recent years is that I think one universal piece of advice that most people know and most specialists in the field will tell you is that it's not so much this chair or this mouse that will be the solution to all of your ergonomic problems. It's actually the ability to vary what you use. So you're not actually using the one input device all day from morning to evening, but you've actually got a variety of options to essentially, you know, because if it's caused by repetitive stress, like the repetitive motions causing these problems, then if you're just changing the motion, so sometimes you use a tablet, sometimes it's a vertical mouse, sometimes it's a trackpad, then that's going to basically, give your hand a variety of different ways that you're exerting it, and therefore, you know, reduce that repetitive motion problem. So, yeah, that's what Therese, my colleague, she specifically told me that as well. She said, look, getting a vertical mouse is not going to be, you know, if you're just going to go from a regular mouse full-time to a vertical mouse full-time, you might find that basically, yes, you might fix the problem with the underside of your wrist, but you may have other problems that come up because you're still doing repetitive motion. The real trick is doing what you've done, Vince, or also you, Mike, with the Magic Mouse and the Magic Trackpad, is giving yourself different options so that you can switch between them, just like you would with a standing desk where you might stand up sometimes, you might sit down, you know, you might rock around a bit. Yeah, it's the idea of just switching it up, I think, that is most effective.
Here are two interface interactions that I do very often, and I'm curious how both of you do them in your respective DAWs. And I realize that this is kind of a combination of a workflow question and an ergonomics question, because it might be that your workflow does not involve these particular actions, or your DAWs are different enough so that it's not an issue. But one thing I do often is scrolling left and right on the timeline in Logic. That's a very common utilitarian sort of thing. And the other thing I do is compress or expand the scope of the timeline. So I might be zoomed in on the horizontal axis on just a few measures, and then I might want to say, okay, I want to see the entire queue, and I zoom out. And the way that I do these things respectively is on the Magic Mouse, I just simply slide my finger left or right on sort of the top third of the Magic Mouse, and that's tied to scrolling in Logic the way I have it set up. And to expand or compress the timeline, I move over to the Magic Trackpad and I do the two-finger pinch or two-finger expand. And those will, in a very kind of physical analog, open or, you know, close the width of the timeline. So it feels very natural. It almost feels like a extension of my body, like I'm reaching out and I'm physically compressing an accordion file or something like that. So assuming these actions are as common for you as they are for me, what do you do typically to affect them?
Vince?
Yeah, for me, it is... Yeah, I'm just actually messing around with it right now. I can do it on the trackpad and do it pretty easily, but usually I just use the scroll wheel along with the Alt and Control modifiers on my keyboard. It's a little bit coarse, but it's very fast to be like, okay, Alt scroll wheel in order to quickly move left and right. And that is what I regularly do. But you've got me now messing around with the trackpad to do this, and it's so nice how smooth that trackpad is and how variable and precise you can be with that zoom there. And now I'm wondering if I'm going to experiment with that more. What about you, Alex?
Yeah, I actually, the trackpad was another option that I was considering, because I use a Mac for all the business work that I do. And I just love the Apple trackpads. I remember that moment. I think we've all had that moment when you try one of these modern Apple trackpads and you realize that when the power is off, it's actually totally solid. And you realize that the whole time you're pressing it, nothing's actually moving. It's not indenting at all. It's just vibrating under your finger, which is just amazing. But anyway, I did actually consider a trackpad because... but then I was also recalling that, you know, with a trackpad, still the same situation where the heel of my wrist would be on the table, and that's where my hand is grounded, is like on the... So basically, it's the same position as using a mouse. It's just that instead of clicking, the rest of the finger motions are slightly different, but it's just the same position. That's why I didn't go with a trackpad. Anyway, to your question, Mike, so I use three DAWs. I use Cubase for music and Reaper for sound effects, and I use Renoise for music as well. And Renoise, obviously, it doesn't really enter this conversation because that's a tracker. And therefore, it's that the whole paradigm of how you use it is completely different. And that, you know, you pretty much 70 or 80% of using a tracker is on the QWERTY keyboard. And so, yeah, basically navigation is done using the page up and page down button because it's a vertical scrolling list. And then if going left and right, if you've got a lot of channels, then you're just using tab and shift tab to move forwards and backwards between them. So you don't ever really... And if you're moving around, if you want to navigate through the list with the mouse, then obviously you're just using the scroll wheel up and down or shift scroll wheel to go left and right as you would with a spreadsheet. So yeah, that's kind of a not really relevant to this discussion. As for Reaper and Cubase, I use the middle mouse button in Reaper. And this was a problem for me that I realized yesterday, is that the Logitech gaming mouse that I used to use has a very stiff middle button click. And I think that could have been part of the problem, that it required quite a lot of force to click in with the middle button click. And that's fatiguing my finger, and then also exacerbated by a lack of circulation under the wrist, was, I think, is what caused, what triggered this to suddenly accelerate yesterday. And so with this vertical mouse, what I've done is I've remapped the middle mouse button click to one of the thumb buttons on this Logitech vertical mouse. And through today, it's been fantastic. So basically, I just click the thumb button, and then that's the middle click. And then now I can scroll left and right just by grabbing the timeline and moving it left and right. And then as for zooming in and out or compressing and expanding, as you said, in Reaper by default, that just the scroll wheel up and down inside the main arrange view, that will zoom in and out. So basically, it's a combination of those two. And in Cubase, it is control and scroll will go left and right. And the zoom in and out, no, sorry, middle mouse button will go left and right, or can pan left and right, and then control scroll wheel will zoom in and out, or the classic Steinberg Cubase shortcuts, which haven't changed in literally many decades, and that is the G and the H keys on with your left hand will also compress and expand the timeline in greater intervals, making it quite easy just to sort of tap it a few times to zoom in and tap it a few times to zoom out with your left hand. So, basically a lot of middle mouse button work over here. So as another tip for anybody who's dealing with this, is that you might find that if the middle mouse button requires a lot of force to press, try remapping that to a thumb button or some other button and using that instead. And the other one that I did that I remapped, so this Logitech Lift has two thumb buttons, a forward one and a back one. So I've got the forward one set for middle mouse click. And actually, I've got the back button set for double click. And that's been really great. Because again, I'm trying to reduce the amount of clicking that I'm doing with my pointer finger as much as possible. And double clicking is pretty bad, you know. And obviously, in a DAW, you need that a lot for a lot of double clicking. And so moving that to the back thumb button has also, it takes a lot of getting used to, because that's a real muscle memory thing to just like double click this clip, or like double click that media asset, or double click this knob to reset the value, all of that. I have to sort of remind myself, oh, wait, I don't need a double click. I can use this thumb button now. But that's also been very helpful.
That's a panoply of different approaches to things. What's interesting about all of these ergonomic interactions that we've discussed is, by and large, they're the ones that you don't ever want to consciously think about. You want to navigate around your DAW or select things or expand or contract the view sort of intuitively. You don't want to be making a deliberate decision to interact with your DAW in this way. You just want it to intuitively fly by. But there's also a category of interactions that are more conscious, that are more artistic decision-making. And I'll just pick one example of infinity. In Logic, one thing I do on MIDI sequences is apply non-destructive quantize. So I click on a bunch of notes and I'll say non-destructively quantize that to an eighth note. And I recently mapped that to buttons on an app on a secondary iPad. Mm. And it made me realize how many physical motions I had previously had to execute in order to get that same effect. And this is a blemish on Logic's otherwise pretty well thought out UI, but I would have to move the pointer all the way to the upper left corner, click on a disclosure triangle that would show parameters of a region, which is Logic's way of saying a bunch of MIDI data, click in a very small target for the current non-destructive quantize, and then I forget if it's a pop-up menu or a drag and scroll through options, but it's definitely something horrible. So what I would take out of this entire experience and offer to our listeners is, every now and then, do a big review as to how you physically interact with your DAW. I mean, you're physically interacting with your input devices and you're sort of virtually interacting with your DAW. But think about the physical ergonomics of pointers and mouses and all the stuff we've been talking about today. And then think about the digital ergonomics. I'm sure there's a real term for that, but I'm just going to say that. How you are, of many options, which are the options you're choosing to affect things through sliding pointers and clicking on things and holding down things while you move things to other places, and ask yourself if you can do it a better way. Mm. In particular, be on the lookout for small targets, very small areas on your DAW's display where you have to move a pointer or equivalent and do some kind of motion within that area. Because I think that is a productivity killer, or at least a tax. It's definitely a productivity tax. But do a review every now and then. Just look at the things you've automated that you take for granted and do without thinking and say, can you do this more effectively or with less fatigue? And I think it will be rewarding.
Yeah, that's really, really good advice. And I'm going to light a fire and then continue to douse it with plenty of oil here by bringing Reaper into the conversation, because I've developed a real love-hate relationship with Reaper, I'm sorry to say. I think seasoned users of Reaper will know where I'm going with this. Reaper, on the one hand, allows you to do exactly what you said there, Mike, with more effectiveness than any other DAW. You can literally change absolutely anything about the way that it works, which is brilliant. So if you want to do that, you know, if you want to take a little bit of a review of the way that you use the software and figure out if there are more ergonomic and efficient ways to achieve things, Reaper is the way to do it. I mean, it's great the amount that you can customize it. And if you have a specific workflow that you're trying to make more efficient, or you're trying to recreate from some other tool, Reaper is the place to do it. The part where the hate part of this love-hate relationship is that Reaper, the general philosophy behind how it's designed is that, okay, nobody knows a user's workflow better than the user themselves, so we're not even going to try. We're not even going to attempt to make this thing comfortable to use, because we know that you know how you want to use it better than we do. So who are we to sort of, you know, force on you our idea of efficient workflow and efficient user experience? That's your job to do that for yourself and make the ideal environment for how you like to work. That's great. You know, that's fantastic. And that's a very valid and clearly effective philosophy behind how to make the software. But also, sorry, but, you know, when you're in a hurry, when you're on a deadline and you're just trying to race through stuff as fast as you can and your wrist is hurting because you haven't got that vertical mouse yet and, you know, things are on fire and you, this has to be done and all of that. It's like, oh my God, Reaper, why are you so slow? Why is everything so difficult until I, as you said, Mike, until I take a pause and say, hold on, let me just review here. Is there a more efficient way I could set this up? Yes, there is. And then you can do that. But if you don't have the patience or the time or the interest to go and find that and customize it and experiment and tweak it yourself, Reaper is absolutely horrible, in my opinion. In my opinion. And, you know, I love Reaper for all of the other reasons that we all love Reaper in the game industry. That's fine. But, yeah, just the user experience out of the box, it's not good if you're in a hurry. Let's in my opinion, again. Sorry, Vince. I know you've recently... Well,
I would not disagree with what you said there. Yeah, I mean, it's a double-edged sword. This is very much a double-edged sword. You can configure everything, but you also need to configure everything in order to really, really work efficiently. So, yeah, I agree.
Yeah, it's... I don't know. I, as I said, I just have this love-hate relationship with it. Your specific point there, Mike, is very, very timely because I've noticed that for some reason, whenever I am in a hurry doing work, I used to get a much more sore wrist from a day of Reaper versus a day of Cubase. And I couldn't figure out why that was. And I've been trying to do that review, Mike, and trying to think, is it like, does Reaper just somehow involve more clicking? Like more? Is it because I need to use the middle mouse button a lot and that was hurting my finger because it was so stiff on the gaming mouse that I was using up until today? Is that the reason that Reaper makes me more tired, or is there something else very unergonomic about the way that my Reaper is set up, whereas Cubase, which clearly, you know, Cubase is not perfect and it's a bit clunky and old-fashioned, of course, but it's pretty clear that Steinberg has a department or at least one or two people whose job it is to design user experience and user interface in a way that's efficient and quick and easy to use, whereas Reaper evidently does not. That's you, the user, who has to do that. But yeah, I had this thing where it's like, why is it that after a day of using Cubase, I don't have that problem? Is it because I mainly do music in Cubase and therefore I'm playing the keyboard sometimes, or I'm playing bass or guitar, or, you know, or is it because just simply Reaper is not set up for me at the moment so that I'm just doing a lot of clicking around? Or maybe is it because Reaper is actually very, very efficient in terms of when it comes to sound effects creation, you can work very quickly in Reaper. So therefore the amount of clicking that I'm doing is more because I'm actually just working more quickly. Yeah, I don't know. It's, Reaper. Anyway, yeah. So I've just set the game audio community alight there by criticizing. No, I'm joking. Of course, you know, I think everybody who's used Reaper will have probably thought that at some point. It's like, wow, this is great. It's also not great, but I can make it great. So, yeah, Reaper. Mike, when are you going to start using Reaper? Never.
I've looked at it a few times, and I just couldn't get past that out of the box ugliness that I associate with amateurism. And I know that that's ironic because Reaper is designed for configurability and it is kind of a pro tool in many ways, but it's like, if I have to look at something all the time, it had better be at least reasonably pleasing.
Yeah. And it's a Windows XP. Just take yourself back to the Windows XP days, and that's Reaper. And it's funny that Reaper, everybody will say, oh, but you've got lots of themes and you can customize it to look however you want. Yeah, great. But I just want to do some work, and I don't want to fall down this rabbit hole of comparing themes and you know, seeing which ones I like better. I just want to get the job done. So Yeah, I find that a good, healthy sort of Windows XP mindset helps you see over the inherent, like, fuggliness of Reaper. Vince, what's your take?
I like Reaper. I really do. I mean, I've tried things that look prettier, but yeah, I've really fallen in love with how workmanlike the interface is. It's not very pretty, but it does its job really quite well, and it doesn't really get in the way. And I appreciate a lot of things. Actually, I recently updated from Reaper 5 to Reaper 6.
Recently?
Yeah, wow. I know. It's kind of funny that because Reaper 6...
We're 6.75 now, Vince.
Ah, darn it. I'm at 6.73. So, no, I was on 5.99 for the longest time. You know, I think there was just this worry that maybe I shouldn't do that upgrade. Oh, I do have to spend a little bit more money to go from Reaper 5 to Reaper 6 because, you know, when you purchase a Reaper license, it's good for two major version numbers. So I first bought Reaper in the Reaper 4.x days, which entitled me to... you know, free updates all the way up to the very end of 5.999. And, okay, well, maybe I'll buy a Reaper 6. This was actually a year or so ago when I actually bought it, but I couldn't actually bring myself to actually update it because I thought, oh, is there anything that I need to worry about? Long story short, I didn't really have to worry about anything because I could quickly... export all of my custom stuff into some config files that I can re-import once I updated with this Reaper 6.7, which is literally 2 years in the future from the last version that I was using, and everything was fine. Yeah. But yeah, I am now back up to date on Reaper, and I have a very slightly... prettier theme that I'm working with, but only slightly. But that's okay because it still works just as efficiently as I've always used it.
Yeah, you don't really have to worry about updating with Reaper. That's one thing. Actually, I was in a similar situation because I also got onto Reaper at version 4, and I actually bought version 6 anyway because I was pretty confident that the upgrade process would be just seamless and fine, unlike Steinberg, which is often a disaster. I knew that Reaper would be just fine. And also, you know, I really, really support everything that the Reaper company, the small, because I think there's only three of them. There's Justin Frankel of Winamp fame, who's the main person behind it. But I really sort of support everything that it stands for, so I bought it anyway. But yeah, you don't really have to worry about transitioning with anything with Reaper. So what's the name of your Reaper theme, Vince?
I mean, let me look at it because it's running right now.
What's it called?
Oh, I mean, it's just a derivative of default. It really is. I just did a little bit of adjusting on there, and it's basically Reaper default. I've been Reaper default ever since the 4 days, so.
Okay, right. Yeah, yes, themes. Anyway, Mike, you are right. It's butt ugly, and it's let's call it utilitarian, I think most positive. Yeah, the most positive way you could, or Windows XP, if I guess that's positive to you. anyway, well, look at that. We've just spent a game audio hour talking about ergonomics and Reaper. So, but yeah, if whoever's listening to this, please take care of your health. Please take care of your hearing, and please take care of your wrists, because obviously these are the two essential things that we need, and we're all here to do this long term. So do whatever it takes. I encourage you to try vertical mouse. It's worked for me so far, or a tablet or a touchpad or anything. Just do what you have to do. And as Mike said, I think Mike's suggestion is also really, really good, to just take a little bit of a step back from your processes and one and just, you know, evaluate whether or not there's a more efficient way to do things. So, yeah, if you take anything away from this rather curious discussion that we've had during this show, it should be take care of yourself.
Yeah, definitely. Well, we should cap off the episode in the usual fashion, which means conspicuous consumption. Mike, have you checked out anything recently?
It was a backwards week for me gaming-wise. I played a lot of Civ 5, and which is routinely referred to as a dad game, even though I'm not a dad. So that was humiliating, but also very gratifying because it is like an eternal game that never really gets old. On the non-interactive media front, I finished watching the third season of Umbrella Academy, which manages to be a very engaging show, despite not really withstanding the scrutiny of thinking about the plot too carefully. The score, I think, is really interesting from the standpoint of managing to take this cinematic musical language for supernaturalism, for apocalypse, for sci-fi, and make it entertaining and funny without losing the sense of stakes. And I know that's a very abstract, wordy way of characterizing music, but I think the score manages to strike that balance between feeling like something huge and supernatural and superpowered is going on. That's very exciting, but with a little bit of levity at the same time. Have either of you watched that show?
I haven't. I tried a little bit of the first season and I was like, oh, okay. But I didn't actually get deep into it. I wasn't watching that much TV in general when that was originally coming out. So it would take me quite a while to get up to this point. You said this is the fourth season?
Third.
Ah, third season. Okay. Well, maybe I should check that out. I mean, it looks like it could be a fun series, but I just need to spend a little bit more time with that. I guess generally when games and TV collide, I tend to go for the games, even though these days I actually haven't been playing that many games right now. Although I will say that I'm very excited to plug in my PlayStation VR 2. I just got in the mail yesterday. And actually, right after this, I am so excited to get that up and running so I can play some Gran Turismo 7 on it. So in anticipation of that, I've been playing a little bit more Gran Turismo than usual. And again, it struck me the really ridiculous divide that exists between the music in the menu and interface and the music that is in game. I turned down the music volume in game all the way because I just do not need this sort of rock music to hype up the driving experience, which is already really, really good. While in the interface sections, I'm very happy to have the sort of, you know, remixes of classical music and sort of more down-tempo jazz fusion there to accompany me while I'm dealing with things like, oh, yeah, what should I make my gear ratios? And I wonder what other car I can collect over here. Like, that felt great. But, yeah, Gran Turismo, it's such a funny music direction that they decided on for that game. And thankfully, there's half of the soundtrack that I do really, really love. It's just not the stuff that's actually playing while you're driving.
Yeah, actually, that's interesting. We should probably save that for another episode. Music for driving games. Because I'm the same. I always prefer to have no music while I'm driving. And then, you know, good music in the menus and the other parts of the interface. But like when I'm driving, I've never really played a music game, except for one. There's an indie isometric driving game called Art of Rally.
Oh, Art of Rally. That is That's a good one. I remember playing that a couple years back. I thought that was really fun.
Yeah, that one, the driving music during that is really, really good. It's sort of synthwave kind of stuff, and it just fits with the low-poly kind of art style that they've got there. Now, that works really well, but in any other sort of 3D driving game that's striving for realism, I've never really enjoyed music so while you're driving. But yeah, that's a topic for another discussion.
We could even expand that topic and ask what kind of game experiences lend themselves to music or lend themselves to silence. Is there a particular kind of gaming experience that maybe has audio immersion or it's very sensory motor, and in those situations we don't want to hear music no matter how good it is. So maybe put a thumbtack on that for a future episode.
That sounds cool.
Yeah. Well, what about you, Alex? What games have you been playing?
Not so much games. Excuse my language, but I've been having my ass kicked by an amazing album that I discovered last week, which has just been kicking my head around so much as like how incredible it is. It's from 1990. It's called Toy Matinee by a group called Toy Matinee. It was a group that has an interesting background in that they... basically, a bunch of session musicians and songwriters had come off very high-profile, successful projects such as Bad by Michael Jackson and Like a Prayer by Madonna, and had sort of managed to get themselves into a situation where they could score a record deal for themselves. So you've got sort of like a cream-of-the-crop songwriting team, production team, and musicians, including Guy Pratt on bass and the legendary session guitarist Tim Pierce on guitar. They basically made one album, and it's called Toy Matinee. And it's not progressive pop music, but it's just very, very musically sophisticated pop music, exquisitely produced, and it is absolutely phenomenal. It's from 1990. You can find it on Spotify and Apple Music. Just type in Toy Matinee, and the first song, it's just one of those things. I think we've all had those moments where you just sort of, you know, you slouch your shoulders down, you sit back in your seat, and you just throw your arms up in the air, and you say, well, why even bother anymore? this is the zenith point right here. I mean, let's just all give up and say, okay, yep, music, that's been done. Time to move on to something else. Anyway, it is really sensational. It's a very sophisticated, it's very complex pop music. The performances, as you would expect from the top line of session musicians in the pop scene from the late 80s and the 90s, as you would expect, it is world class. Just the music is fantastic. It's just exceptional. So a real recommendation for me for Toy Matinee from 1990. So that's what I've been not so conspicuously consuming.
That sounds really cool. I am looking at this right now and thinking, yeah, this is probably pretty sophisticated if it has two tracks that are also dedicated to Salvador Dali and Vaclav Havel. I was like, huh? Yes. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. It's the production of it is, and the performances are just, you know, if an alien landed and said, hey, tell me about this pop music thing that you humans do, can you recommend something, like just one song for me to take back to my home planet? that's going to happen. I would say, yeah, check out Last Plane Out, the first song on Toy Matinee's self-titled 1990 album. There you go. You're welcome. Go and take pop music to the universe.
All right.
Well, your music recommendations have been 100% as far as I'm concerned, so I'll be checking this out.
Ah, cool. Appreciate that. Yeah, I like music. Don't we all?
Music is cool. So on that note, it's time to say goodbye to episode 238 of the Game Audio Hour. If you liked what you heard, feel free to support us by subscribing to us at your podcast purveyor of choice and leaving us a review to keep us in the forefront of the algorithm. You can also follow us on Twitter at Game Audio Hour, where we also post notices about future episodes, as well as try to support some other fun and positive voices out there in the Twitterverse. And of course, the easy way to do all of that without having to remember what I just said this last minute is to go to GameAudioHour.com. So go ahead and do that while I try to wrangle my PlayStation VR 2 setup. Bye.